You're listening to DTFHN for March 13th, 2026. I'm your eventually consistent host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News. A website W section is usually smarter than the article. Today, everything that should have arrived sooner finally did, and it was worth the wait. Let's move. For 10 years, attackers could register a bucket with the same name as one you just deleted. And anything still pointing to that name would start feeding data to a stranger. That's the story of bucket squatting. And AWS just fixed it. Run this forward. You are a company. You spin up infrastructure. You use a sensible naming convention. My app is one per is relied for. Perfectly readable. Perfectly guessable. You delete it during a cleanup pass, maybe a migration, maybe a sunset. The name goes back into the global pool. Someone watching for patterns registers it before you notice it's gone. Now your old CloudFormation templates, your legacy services, your anything. That didn't get updated. The rain is someone else's bucket. The fix is elegant in the way that good security engineering often is. Obvious in hindsight, invisible until someone thought to do it. AWS introduced an account namespace. The new naming convention looks like this. Your prefix accounted region descendancy. That trailing N stands for account namespace. The account ID is embedded in the bucket name itself, and AWS enforces it at the API layer. If your account ID is in the name, only your account can own it. Another account tries to create that bucket. They get an invalid bucket namespace error. The name was never in the global pool to begin with. Admire the architecture here for a moment. This isn't a policy layer. It isn't IAM rules. It isn't a checkbox in the console. It's a structural guarantee baked into the naming scheme. The security property is enforced by the syntax. That's how you build durable protections. Not please don't do this, but you cannot do this. AWS went further. There's a new condition key, S3-XFDMZ bucket namespace, which lets security administrators enforce this pattern across an entire organization through SCP policies. One policy, every account, no exceptions. The honest caveat, this doesn't protect existing buckets. If your infrastructure is already out there with region suffix names, that exposure doesn't go away. The migration is real work. But for everything going forward, the attack surface closes. One commenter put it well, this is the kind of good hygiene convention that saves you from having to think about it each time. The best security is the kind you can stop thinking about. Because the architecture handles it, a decade to get here. Worth it. Moving on. The strongest argument for AWS taking a decade to fix this is also the most honest. Backwards compatibility is genuinely hard at scale. There are billions of S3 buckets, infrastructure templates, Terraform modules, CDK constructs, IAM policies with hard-coded names baked into production, the blast radius of a namespace change. Done wrong is measured in outages, not developer hours. Respecting that constraint isn't cowardice, it's engineering discipline. Now follow that argument to its actual conclusion. If backwards compatibility is the binding constraint, the fix was always going to be opt-in, which means existing buckets stay exposed, which means the decade of conversation Ian McKay was having with the AWS security outreach team, dozens of individual communication, was about a problem everyone acknowledged nobody could remediate retroactively, and new customers kept inheriting anyway. The constraint that made the fix difficult also made it permanently partial. Run the underlying principle all the way. If global uniqueness is your namespace model, you have built a tragedy of the commons by design. Every bucket name is a shared resource. Every deleted bucket is a land rush. The squatter isn't violating the system. They're using it as specified. The vulnerability isn't a bug. It's the premise. Google Cloud scoped buckets to projects from the start. Azure scoped to accounts and containers. AWS built the world's largest objects store on an assumption of good faith in a globally shared namespace, and then spent a decade genuinely surprised when people didn't comply. What AWS shipped is real and worth recognizing. The in suffix, the account ID embedded in the name, the S3, XAMZ, bucket namespace condition key for SCKB enforcement. This closes the attack surface for everything going forward. Organization-wide policy enforcement means you don't rely on individual teams to remember the convention under deadline pressure. One commenter flagged the account ID exposure question. Reasonable instinct, wrong conclusion. Account IDs are already semi-public in AWS. They appear in ARNs, cross-account policies, CloudTrail logs shared with partners. Obscurity was never the protection on offer. Structural unambiguity is a different thing entirely. A decade, one suffix, the fix was always available. AWS just had to decide the commons needed a fence. Today's stories are a clinic in infrastructure problems finally getting solved. Story 3 is another one. In 90 Bag A, Steve Belevin wrote a paper documenting something the network security community had quietly understood for years. TCP's initial sequence numbers were predictable. If you could guess the next number in a sequence, you could inject packets into an established session. Session hijacking without ever observing the traffic. The vulnerability wasn't in any specific implementation. It was in the architecture. Every TCP stack had it because they all followed the same spec. The fix was structural. Randomize the initial sequence number. Embed entropy directly into the identifier. Make prediction infeasible by design rather than by hope. RFC 1948 formalized this in 1996. Full deployment across real-world systems took another decade. The pattern should be recognizable. A shared infrastructure primitive. TCP sequence spaces as Sripakin names. Where identifiers live in a flat global namespace and reuse is permitted by design. Predictability creates attack surface. The fix, when it arrives, is always the same move. Namespace the identifier with something only one party can control. That's what AWS has finally shipped with the account namespace pattern. Bucket names now embed your account ID and region in a format AWS enforces against the creating account. My app 1234567890112.39 cannot be registered by any other account. The attack surface closes because the name carries unforgeable provenance from the moment of creation. Ian McKay spent a decade pushing on this. Dozens of communications with AWS security outreach, individual services, CloudFormation templates. The intervention required was as organizational as it was technical. AWS's own infrastructure teams were generating predictable names with region suffixes, embedding the exact anti-pattern they needed to eliminate, in official guidance. The new condition key matters as much as the naming convention. S3, jingly X, dash, S bucket. Namespecs allow security teams to enforce the pattern at the organization level through SCPEs. You don't rely on every developer, every template, every under pressure Friday deploy to remember. Policy does the work. Existing buckets receive no retroactive protection. Migration is the path forward for legacy risk. The TCP story took 15 years to absorb fully. Flat global namespaces with reusable identifiers are attack surfaces waiting. The fix is always the same. Bind the identifier to an unambiguous owner at creation time. Structurally, not by convention. AWS made that move. 10 years later than it should have arrived, but the architecture is now sound. Sound architecture takes 10 years to land. PaaSSORY 4 is about the mindset that builds it in the first place. Richard Hamming had a line about the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He said, and this is the specific thing worth sitting with, that IAS had ruined more good scientists than any institution has created. Not failed to produce. Ruin. The word is precise. Hamming wasn't saying they stopped working. He was saying something happened to them there that degraded the quality of what came after. And the mechanism he identified was simple. Recognition. Once you're known for something extraordinary, you stop planting acorns. You reach for the oak tree directly. The bar you're now held to. The bar you hold yourself to becomes the thing that paralyzes you. Sharif Shamim wrote a short piece this week that starts from the same place and goes somewhere genuinely elegant. He describes how he used to publish constantly, freely, without anxiety. He knew nobody was reading. He knew some of it sucked. He published anyway. And occasionally wrote something that mattered. Now, older and objectively more skilled, he can barely hit publish. The question he's circling but doesn't quite ask directly, what if the mechanism that makes you better at your craft is structurally incompatible with doing your best work? Because that's what this is, the thing that builds your skill. Accumulated reputation, external expectations, the weight of your own prior output is also the thing that turns the blank page into a threat assessment. Good ideas always sound stupid at first. The Macintosh team averaged 21 years old. Xerox PARC researchers were mostly under 30. The advantage wasn't intelligence or work ethic. It was that nobody expected anything of them yet. They could follow curiosity into weird corners without the editorial board of their own past success evaluating every move. Hamming's word, ruined, is doing heavy lifting. It implies something irreversible. But Shamt's essay suggests the damage is structural, not permanent. The fix is deliberate. Say the bad ideas out loud. Publish the uncertain thing. Let the stupid thought exist long enough to find out whether it's actually stupid. The tools are available. The knowledge is there. The acorn is right in front of you. The question is whether you've convinced yourself you can only plant oaks. A pattern emerging today. The best thinking happens when you stop managing appearances. Story 5 keeps that thread going. There's a design pattern I've seen in content moderation systems where engineers burned by a few high-profile failures keep adding precision layers to the filter. Each layer makes the system more selective, more careful. And then one day someone pulls the metrics and discovers the system is now flagging 60% of legitimate content as problematic. The fix for occasional errors was total output collapse. The cure was more disabling than the disease. The brewer has a name for this dynamic. In fermentation, the instinct to eliminate variability. To sterilize everything, control every variable, permit no wild yeast. Produces something technically perfect and functionally dead. The industrial lager is the end point of this logic. No contamination, no surprise, no flavor worth discussing. The craft brewer does something that looks irresponsible. They introduce uncertainty. They let things interact that shouldn't. They accept that some batches will be wrong so that others can be genuinely interesting. Controlled mess is the mechanism, not the failure mode. Sharif Shane published an essay last week about why he stopped publishing. He's a better writer now than he was 3 years ago. Better ideas, more experience, more to say. But he can't hit publish. And he understands exactly why. He got good enough that his own standards started running the filter. He pulls the Hamming quote about the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. How it ruined more good scientists than it created, measured by what they produced before and after arriving. The Nobel effect. You become the laureate, and suddenly, every idea has to clear the Nobel bar before it's allowed to exist. Here's what the essay captures that most productivity writing misses. The problem isn't confidence, it's architecture. You've built a gate between ideation and output, and the gate's calibration is wrong. It's running the 60% false positive filter. And the gate feels like wisdom because it is made of real knowledge. You actually do know more about what makes writing bad. That knowledge is correct. The application is the bug. His friend Adele has the fix, and it's disarmingly low-tech. Say the bad ideas out loud. Not to find the bad ones, to move through them. The brewery has to run the batch. One commenter pushed back. Success sometimes frees people to share things they wouldn't have risked earlier. Both are true. The variable isn't success. It's whether the filter is serving the work or consuming it. Run the batch. Find out what you made. We are on a theme today. Story 6. Two systems improve when you practice a skill, execution. The ability to produce the work, evaluation. The ability to judge it. They don't track together. They don't improve at the same rate or in the same direction. Output quality improves more or less linearly. Evaluation sharpens faster and compounds. Every piece of bad work you've seen, every cringe at your own writing from 3 years ago, adds resolution to the error detection layer. The pattern library grows. So does its confidence. The problem is structural. Genuinely new ideas are unrecognizable to an existing pattern library. That's nearly the definition of new. If an idea fits established patterns cleanly, it's not particularly original. A real departure looks like an error to any system trained on what came before. As the evaluation layer matures, it gets better at blocking things that don't fit, including the things worth making. Sharif documents this from a personal angle. A writer who publishes less now than when he was worse. And Signal shows up everywhere. The Macintosh team averaged 21 years old. Xerox PARC researchers were mostly under 30. Young researchers producing work that surprises people twice their age. Not because they're smarter, and not because they work harder. Their calibration is incomplete in the useful direction. The false positive rate on bad ideas is high, but the false negative rate on strange good ideas is low. The filter hasn't hardened. The social dimension compounds this. The evaluation system doesn't fail internally first. It fails externally, then internalizes. Every paper after the Nobel is measured against the Nobel. Reputation becomes the ceiling. The researcher with nothing to protect follows the thread that looks stupid, because the downside is bounded. In exploratory work, status is a liability. One commenter pushed back. Success sometimes frees people to share things they wouldn't have risked before. That's true. The variable isn't the success itself. It's whether external evaluation pressure has internalized. Some people accumulate reputation and feel more free. Others accumulate it and start protecting it. Same input, different filter response. Adel's fix works for a specific reason. You don't negotiate with a miscalibrated filter. You flood it, produce the bad ideas deliberately, fast, until something gets through. Volume defeats the gate. The knowledge is available to anyone willing to be wrong in public. The pattern library isn't the obstacle. It's an asset running the wrong objective function. Moving on. What does it mean for a model to understand something versus execute it? That distinction has been fuzzy for years. We've had models that could describe bubble sort, models that could write it, models that could call a Python interpreter to run it. The Percepta.ai team just made it considerably fuzzier. They built a method for executing programs inside transformers. Not by calling out to external tools, but by running the computation through the model's own forward pass. The inference speedup, in the right conditions, is exponential. Here's where I want to play devil's advocate, because one of the sharper comments in the thread deserves a real answer. Is a transformer that offloads computation to Python really that different from Python code being read and executed by a compiler? Both are symbolic systems interpreting symbols. Both have a layer of abstraction between the representation and the execution. It's a good challenge, and the answer is interesting. The difference isn't philosophical. It's architectural. When you call out to Python, you're breaking the forward pass. You're serializing state, handing it off, waiting for a response, rehydrating context. That's latency. That's bandwidth. That's a context window management problem. When computation happens inside the model, you stay inside the matrix, multiply. No serialization boundary. No round trip. The state is the activations. It's already where it needs to be. The exponential speed-up claim comes from eliminating that overhead at scale. For programs that require many iterative tool calls, each call that stays internal is a latency you don't pay. Compounding that across a long computation is where the exponential comes from. What's technically admirable here? And this is the engineering worth appreciating. Is that this implies the transformer's internal representations are rich enough to track program state across steps? The weights are doing something like maintaining a register file. That's not a metaphor. That's a claim about what's actually happening in the forward pass. The interpretability angle is the real treasure. If a significant fraction of a model's behavior is pseudo-symbolic, if something like program execution is happening in the activations, then we've just found a window, not into the mystical black box of general reasoning, but into a structured, legible, inspectable subprocess. That's debuggable. That's auditable. One commenter called it a path for interpretability research. That undersells it. If this generalizes, it's a path toward knowing what the model is actually doing when it thinks. Run that forward. Story 8, and this episode just keeps getting weirder and more wonderful. What if transformers aren't just predicting text? What if they're running programs? The first commenter who actually read the paper closely dropped the needle on it immediately. This works, they wrote, but the actual execution happened outside the model. Which is a polite way of saying, the headline and the paper are not quite having the same conversation. Let's strip this down. The claim is exponentially faster inference by executing programs inside transformers. First principles. What does that actually mean? A transformer is a sequence-to-sequence function. It takes tokens in, applies attention, produces distributions over tokens out. Executing a program inside that process could mean two very different things. One, The model is genuinely simulating computation in its forward pass, maintaining state in activations the way a CPU maintains state in registers. 2. The model is generating code, and something else is running it. These are not the same claim. They are not even in the same neighborhood. The paper appears to be doing something closer to the second, with an interesting wrinkle on the first. And here's where it gets worth your attention. If you look past the framing, the real finding is stranger and more interesting than fast inference. Transformers appear to maintain something like program state across forward passes. Not as a metaphor, as a measurable property of the activations. Commoners who work in interpretability lit up at this immediately. Because if a meaningful fraction of model behavior is pseudo-symbolic, if there's a legible sum precise happening that looks like structured execution, then you've found something. You can actually inspect, trace, and audit. One commenter asked the obvious question, why? Our brains can simulate Turing machines too. Slowly. We automated that with silicon for exactly this reason. Why route it back through a model? The answer is probably not speed. The speed claim will be contested in replication and probably is. The answer is interpretability and control. A subprocess you can read is a subprocess you can debug. And another commenter made a point that deserved more traction than it got. Is a transformer offloading computation to Python really different from Python code being read and executed by a compiler? The abstraction layers differ. The fundamental question doesn't. When does a system stop interpreting representations and start being the computation? That question is not settled. This paper. Underneath the AI polished prose in the ambitious headline, another commenter correctly flagged, is genuinely poking at it. The exponential speed-up numbers will shake out. The interpretability angle will not. That's the thread worth pulling. So, if transformers can host computation, what happens when they run it directly? Story 9. A loop executes inside the forward pass, not in a subporcus, not in an external tool, not in Python, spinning up alongside the model. Inside the transformer itself, woven into the attention heads and the residual stream. The paper from Percepta is claiming something architectural, that transformers can run programs as part of their own computation, and that doing so produces exponential inference speedup compared to standard generation. The speedup number will get stress tested in replication. One commenter flagged that time savings aren't universal across tool calls and that GPU batching complicates the picture. That's normal science. The interesting claim survives even if the exponential figure gets revised. Symbolic computation can be embedded in a transformer's mechanics in ways that aren't just pattern completion. This touches something structurally important. Most current tool use works like this. Model generates text. Text gets parsed. Code executes externally. Result injects back as context. The round trip is expensive. The seam is visible. If programs can execute within the forward pass itself, you collapse that seam. Inference and execution become the same operation. That's a meaningful architectural shift. Not just an optimization. What that means in practice depends entirely on whether the weights are open. Because if computation is happening inside the model, interpretability requires access to those weights. A closed transformer running programs internally is a computation substrate you cannot audit. You can observe inputs and outputs. You cannot inspect what ran between them. Or why? This is engineering due diligence, not ideology. External tool calls are transparent by construction. Every call visible, every result traceable, every failure debuggable. Computation folded into proprietary weights is the opposite architecture entirely. Several researchers in the comments noted the interpretability angle. If models begin to operate pseudo-symbolically at scale, understanding what they're doing requires open weights. That's not a value judgment. It's a debugging requirement. The blog post itself suffers from a problem one commenter correctly identified. Fluent prose, low signal density. The writing is polished. The mechanism is underexplained. That's frustrating because the underlying question deserves a clear answer. When does the boundary between model and computation stop being a boundary at all? Brains simulate Turing machines. Slowly. We build computers to handle that. The question of whether computation should live inside transformer weights or alongside them is genuinely open. The interpretability stakes are not. Moving on! The devil's advocate case for Malastatshez is actually pretty strong. Clean room reverse engineering is a legitimate, historically important legal technique. IBM-compatible PCs existed because engineers at Phoenix and Compaq independently reconstructed the BIOS from documentation alone. Never touching IBM source, just observing behavior and writing to spec. Wine exists because developers wrote Windows API behavior from scratch by watching outputs. Samba, React OS. The entire tradition of compatibility layers that kept computing from becoming a permanent monopoly game. The technique works. Courts have upheld it. The principle that you can recreate functional behavior without copying protected expression is foundational to interoperability, competition, and a computing ecosystem that doesn't belong to one company forever. If you take that seriously, Malus is just industrializing a proven approach. Now dismantle it. The difference is intent, and intent is load-bearing here. Phoenix built the BIOS to enable competition. To break a monopoly, to let manufacturers build IBM-compatible machines without paying IBM in perpetuity. Wine was built so people could escape Windows lock-in, not perpetuate it. Every legitimate clean room project in history was aimed at opening something closed. Malus is running the same technique in the opposite direction. The pitch isn't, here's how to escape a proprietary trap. It's here's how to extract from an open ecosystem without contributing back. The indemnification footnote says it plainly. Offshore subsidiary in a jurisdiction that doesn't recognize software copyright. That sentence is doing a lot of work. Run this forward 5 years. Imagine the approach scales. Not Malus specifically. The idea. AI systems trained on public documentation, API specs, and observed behavior, reproducing functionality cleanly enough to pass legal scrutiny. Imagine every company with a compliance team deciding that maintaining open source contributions is optional, because the clean room path is now automated, cheap, and indemnified offshore. What happens to the maintainers? The people who wrote the libraries that defined the API is that the documentation described that the model learned from. The satire is elegant precisely because the threat is architecturally real. It's not that AI can reproduce code. That's been true for a while. It's that the legal fiction of I never saw the original is now manufacturable at scale. What the HN thread noticed correctly. The same technique, run with different intent, could go the other way. Liberate proprietary software. Make closed things open. That inversion is worth taking seriously, and a few commenters did. But the Chad stockholder testimonial is the tell. That's who this is for. And when multiple careful readers parse it twice before recognizing satire, That's not a reading comprehension failure. That's the pitch decks catching up to the parody. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 13th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that should have existed yesterday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.